Of all the natural disasters on Earth, none may be as terrifying as an earthquake. After all, if there's anything we trust, it's that the ground under our feet will stay there. Well, it doesn't always. In what's known as the Great Quake of 64, nothing stayed put. And earthquake watchers will tell you that it's about time for another great quake, somewhere in the great state, sometime in the next 20 years. Good afternoon, I'm Susan McGinnis. Today, before the next great one rocks us, we'll take a look at earthquakes, what causes them, when, and why. My guest is Charlotte Rowe, staff seismologist from the Geophysical Institute at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Charlotte, can we get started with a geological primer? My sense is that most people would think that the Earth is solid under their feet until that aberration known as an earthquake comes into their lives.
Well, that's true, and that's sort of a fundamental basis for day-to-day activities, and of course for how we build our structures and our routine functioning, is that the Earth is solid and it's going to be there when we put our feet on the floor in the morning and get out of bed. Yeah. And we can walk around on it and drive around on it. But as anyone who's experienced an earthquake could tell you, that's not always the case. In fact, the Earth as a whole, not just with an individual earthquake, but over the extent of geologic time, the Earth has been shifting and changing and regenerating itself and destroying old material and creating new material in terms of the surface for the 4.5 odd billion years that the planet's been around.
Can we start at the center and work our way out and see if we can create a picture? I'm asking you for this, and create a picture for our listeners.
Okay. If you imagine the Earth as, say, an apple, and we're going to slice the apple in half and look at the inside, the core. And in fact, the center of the Earth is called, by scientists, the core of the Earth. Inside, at the very center, there's a solid core. And surrounding that, the outer core, we believe to be fluid. And what that is, it's material which is under so much heat and pressure that it flows like a fluid. The liquid outer core and the solid inner core make up the core overall. Outside of that, we have what we call the mantle. And the mantle is generally thought of as a solid, but actually you could say that it's a fluid also. Maybe a plastic would be a better description. Mm. We believe that because of the heat within the Earth, the mantle over very long periods of time will flow in large convection cells, just like in the atmosphere, where you have a warm part which kind of rises up and then comes over and goes back down towards the middle as it cools. Now, outside of the mantle is the very thin outer layer, just like the skin on the apple, which we call the Earth's crust. The Earth's crust is the part that we live on, and the crust is not very thick, maybe 40 kilometers at the most.
And in miles, that is?
That would be maybe 25 miles.
For the metrically impaired?
Yeah. Yeah, maybe 25 miles thick on the average. It varies, of course. It's thicker where the continents are, and mountain ranges have a very thick crust because in addition to going up high, it also goes down a little bit lower beneath them. And it's very thin at the oceans. Well, this crust is, of course, cool. And as we get these large convection cells in the mantle moving around, the crust kind of tends to be rafted around on the outside of it. And the individual pieces of the crust and outer mantle we'll call lithosphere. That's a mouthful, lithospheric plates. But these more rigid, solid masses of rock that are kind of floating on the outside will tend to be moved around, and they can be rifted apart, they can converge together, they come crashing together in certain instances, and this overall process is what causes a lot of the geologic features that we see today on the Earth.
Is the Earth's crust made up of the plates that we hear about when we hear about the phrase tectonic plates, the plates that move during earthquakes or move constantly and create earthquakes?
Right, exactly. And if you've heard the term continental drift, the continents are parts of some of these plates. Some of the plates are just ocean floor. Some of them have continent and ocean. Mm-hmm. And continental drift refers to the motion of the continental masses as they ride around on these plates.
And this is all constant?
Yes.
You brought in a Time Life book called Earthquakes with a passage you read to me just before we started. I wonder if this is a good time. Before you begin, I need to tell people who just tuned in that this is Charlotte Rowe, seismologist from the University of Alaska Fairbanks Geological Institute. She works for the Alaska Earthquake Information Center. And we're talking today about earthquakes on Sunday at noon. Please read.
Okay, I thought this was a really clever passage. It says, what once was assumed to be a stable ball of static material, this is referring to the Earth, whirling sedately through space, is in fact a seething, many-layered conglomeration of molten and solid materials carapaced over with twisting, shifting plates of rock. Man is clinging to the skin of a planet still involved in the elemental forces of creation, ever-changing, never at rest.
And the Will Durant piece.
Oh, yes.
I like that, too.
The historian Will Durant kind of summed it up, as far as we're concerned, very nicely. He said, civilization exists by geologic consent, subject to change without notice.
Don't make permanent plans over geological history.
Exactly. The only thing constant is change.
And earthquakes, I understand. Or earth movements.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. Something I think you mentioned to me and then I read before getting started on this program was that there was one continent, it is thought, 200 million years ago or so. So we can get a picture of how our continents have come to be through this continental drift and this breaking apart.
Right. A large continent which the geologists and geophysicists call Pangaea was comprised of the continents as we know them today. Actually, they've been moving around for longer than the 200 million years. Pangaea had been sort of glommed together and then split apart a couple of times, the most recent of which was approximately 200 million years ago. And there's an awful lot of evidence, both geological and geophysical, which leads to the conclusion, almost inescapable conclusion, that this is indeed what happened, and that process is still going on today.
Were the ruptures and changes that created Pangaea and then created the continents as we know them more dramatic than movement and changes that go on today? Are we slowing down and are we into our maturity as a planet, or are we still an adolescent where things change a lot?
It seems that things are moving at about the same rate as they ever have been. We have convergence. We have things moving together. We have mountain building going on at what's considered a rapid rate geologically. The Alaska Range is still rising. The Himalayas were created when the Indian subcontinent came crashing up into Asia not so very long ago. To us, it would seem a long time ago, but geologically, it was after this break of Pangaea.
Right. You mentioned the Himalayas and the Aleutians. These are two of the major earthquake centers of the Earth. And there, can we tick off and take a look at some of the others? When I looked at the picture in your office, it seemed that there was a ring that ran around the outer boundaries of the Pacific and then around Africa, South America?
South America.
Right. Yeah. And then up into, I'm not sure where I'm with my direction on the planet here and as my hand whips around in the studio, but up into Europe and into Asia. But it seemed to be a ring that ran around the continents and the oceans.
Right.
Am I seeing that correctly? And is that a good image for our listeners?
Pretty well, yeah. Most of that we would probably say is concentrated around the Pacific Rim.
Mm-hmm.
The Pacific Ocean has a spreading center. In fact, there are a couple of spreading centers in it. These are places where the plates are moving apart. And what happens is you get igneous activity, you get lava coming up and forcing these plates apart. And as they come apart, something has to happen. If you're forever creating new material at these places where the plates are spreading, the planet would keep getting bigger and bigger. But it's not doing that. So as you create new crust, you have to destroy crust somewhere. This occurs at what we call subduction zones.
Okay, translate that for our people here.
If you can imagine two plates or two pieces of the surface of something moving towards one another, and they bump into each other, well, they're not going to stop. We have this inexorable force behind each one of them, and something is going to happen. In the instance of ocean material and continental material, the oceanic material on the floor of the ocean is a heavy, dense lava. It's called basalt. Mm-hmm. The material on the continents is lighter and less dense. It's limestone, sandstone, granite, things like that. So if you think of the mantle as a plastic, then you could think of the continental material as being more buoyant. Right. So if you shove a piece of ocean up against a piece of continent, something has to give. And what's going to happen is that the oceanic material, as I wave my hands around in
sure.
the studio.
Are you watching, folks?
The oceanic material ends up being forced underneath the continental material. Right. And, of course, this doesn't happen gently. There's an awful lot of stresses going on there, a lot of force behind it, and the rocks are going to move against one another. They'll stick, build up pressure, slip. They'll fracture within themselves as they're subjected to all of these pressures, and they'll buckle and bend, and you end up with earthquakes.
Aye. And major earthquakes are occurring all around those areas. I just want to make sure people get the visual here, especially where the oceans meet up against land, because in this constant continental drifting, mm-hmm. things are constantly moving, shoving up against each other, getting buckled down underneath, getting buckled up.
Right.
And that's what's making the ground move underneath our feet.
Or in the case of land meeting land, the Himalayas.
Aye. And under the oceans, too. It's not just...
Correct, the Marianas Trench. Uh-huh. We get very large earthquakes, very deep earthquakes there, which are a result of the subducting plate going way down, and we can get earthquakes as deep as about 700 kilometers or maybe 500 miles below the surface of the Earth until the slab of ocean material gets so far down and it's subjected to the heat, because as you get deeper in the planet, it gets warmer. Oh. It gets warmed up enough that it starts to flow plastically rather than breaking brittly, and at that point you no longer get brittle fracture, which results in earthquakes. But all along the coast of South America, mm-hmm. there is a subduction zone, and they have mm-hmm. large earthquakes there, and they have a mountain range, a very high mountain range, the Andes, which is a result of the buckling and heaving of the overriding continental material as the ocean is forced underneath. Likewise, up through Central America, Alaska, the Alaska mm-hmm. Range, and the whole Aleutian Peninsula and Island Arc, all the volcanoes, are there as a result of this subduction. And of course then you get Kamchatka and Japan, where they have a lot of large earthquakes, and the Philippines, and down around New Zealand, the whole area, Indonesia down there.
Good. We've just traced that whole picture.
The whole circuit.
That's nice. Yeah, we're getting a good, better picture, I think, for our listeners. I keep wanting to ask you in the listening audience whether you're following this. Maybe you're far ahead of me. Who knows? We're listening to Charlotte Rowe today, seismologist with the Geophysical Institute at the University, who's talking to us about earthquakes, sometime prior, we trust, to the Great One coming to Alaska. And a little later in our hour, we'll talk about the Great One or Two or Three that may come to our state as well as to other parts of the world. What you're describing is that the word that is used frequently called plate tectonics. Yes, can you mm-hmm. give us a simple definition of plate tectonics?
Well, it's the general theory which encompasses the whole idea of the crust of the Earth moving around as a result of these large motions within the underlying mantle.
And creating more of itself through mountains right. and trenches. And so it's not only moving around, but it's changing the world, and that's part of the definition as well.
Right. It creates more of itself at the spreading centers. Mm-hmm. The Mid-Atlantic Rise is a very good example. This is a ridge all the way up the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, kind of snakes up and down, that there are volcanoes all along there. And they erupt, and they send out new lava, mm-hmm. and the plates on either side, the material on either side, moves away a little bit as new lava is injected. And then you get more, and it kind of forces it apart. And this whole line of volcanic activity that's moving up the Atlantic comes on shore in Iceland. And you can actually see the volcanic activity in Iceland. This is a spreading center.
And one of the proofs that plate tectonics is a valid theory is that you find pieces of one continent in another and pieces of what is ocean floor in a continent, and
yes.
showing that all these plates are moving.
Uh-huh. There are pieces of Africa in South America.
Yes, yeah. Would you tell me that South America fit into the armpit of Africa?
Of Africa, yes.
Right.
And that was noticed a long time ago. more than a century ago that was noticed. And the idea has been kicked around for quite some time that the continents were moving. There was a very strong resistance to this idea simply because people didn't much like the notion that the world is constantly moving under their feet, and where they are standing may not have existed several million years ago. But the evidence of the rocks and fossils on either sides of the ocean that are identical, mm-hmm. and evidence from magnetic signals that they can see in the rocks showing that they have moved with respect to the Earth's magnetic field, which is a whole other can of worms. But these, all of these things joined together very strongly support the hypothesis that the continents are moving. And one of the best tests of a hypothesis is if you can use it to predict something. And predictions of what kinds of rock types might be found in certain areas, what kinds of fossils might be found in certain areas, if these things hold true, have been time and time again realized. People will make a prediction based on this hypothesis, and this is still a hypothesis. We call it a hypothesis. We don't call it fact yet. Mm-hmm. But based on this hypothesis, people will come up with an idea that they ought to go to some certain place and see something. They'll go out there, and there it is.
Geology is a very young field.
Yes.
Is it remarkable to so early in a science feel comfortable with a hypothesis?
Well, that's hard to say. I think any hypothesis that was the generally accepted one, a majority of people felt comfortable with. Mm-hmm. I think geology, being as young a science as it is, tends to be careful to refer to things as a hypothesis, because most of things are based on deductive reasoning. You go and you look at something and you try and piece together what happened based on the evidence that you have. One of what they call a fundamental tenet of geology is that of multiple working hypotheses. You see something, you try and explain in terms of your understanding of possible physical processes how this might have come to be, but you never close your mind to another possible theory mm-hmm. until something rules it out.
Let's take a look at kind of vibrations and their effects. I mean, where an earthquake starts under the ground, how shallow, how deep, and then kind of as we move along in this next part of our discussion, how and why we are affected, or how it and at what magnitude we're affected by it.
Okay.
Is that a sensible place to start?
Okay. Well, the source for an earthquake is generally thought to be brittle fracture of rocks. If you have a lot of stresses imposed on rocks,
the plates are moving, or they're moving apart, right?
Right. Okay. And you have weak zones in the rocks that we call faults. These are places where the rocks have failed or slipped before. So if you have a lot of pressure going up, you're going to most likely break at a point that's weak. Well, the pressures build up, and the rocks will bend so far. They'll bend a little ways. And then eventually they can bend no farther, and they snap, just like a twig. If you can bend it so far, and then finally it snaps. And the exact point where the snap occurs is what we call the hypocenter of the earthquake. And this is this can vary in depth depending upon where in the earth you are. If you're in the interior of a continent or interior Alaska, it's going to be fairly shallow, maybe down as far as 20 or 30 kilometers, 15 or 20 miles, say. In the oceanic areas, in the trenches where you have the subduction, as I said before, they could be as deep as 700 kilometers. So,
and that's in part because we have these rifts that go down, these great crevices that go down into the ocean?
Well, there are trenches in the ocean surface that it's a surface effect of the downbending of that slab. But the part of the slab that's at this very deep depth, that's not a trench in the ocean. You wouldn't be able to see it if you were looking at the ocean floor. It's way down there, underground.
The way you held your hand, it looked as if something had been shoved down under something else.
Right.
So this is what we're talking about with a subduction center.
Right. It's shoved underneath.
All right.
But we can see it when we can locate the earthquake. When the ground ruptures in the earthquake, it sends out waves. Mm. And it's a shock wave, much like you'd get, say, from a nuclear blast or something. And this shock wave goes out spherically. Roughly, you could think of it going out in all directions from the source of the earthquake at depth. And as the wave moves out, eventually it will reach the surface. And if you have seismometers, instruments at the surface to register the motion, or if you have a city up there that's going to get shaken up and knocked down.
Or both.
Or both, yes. Then these shock waves will be noticed. And as they move farther and farther away from the earthquake, of course, they get smaller and smaller, just like if you drop a pebble in a pond, your first couple ripples are pretty big, and by the time it gets all the way over to the shore, it's small. But the waves will move out radially from the source, and people at different distances will feel them at different intensities. A lot of shaking very close, maybe not so much farther away.
And something we'll talk about later in the program, that people will feel them not only relative to how far they are away from the hypercenter, but they'll also feel them depending on what kind of earth is under their feet,
right,
or what kind of building they're standing in, right? Yeah.
Yes.
So it becomes, when it gets to the top where it affects us, it becomes an everything's relative situation.
Lots of factors influencing that.
Yeah. And if nobody's there, it's like the tree in the forest, right? Yeah. Did it fall or didn't it fall? Don't know. Don't know. How much does the earth actually move where we feel it? Does it move? I mean, I can remember people in for example, my mother and stepfather who went through the recent Loma Prieta earthquake around Santa Cruz. They said it felt like their earth just shook back and forth with great motion, and made me wonder how much the ground actually shook under their feet. Do you know how much ground shakes?
Well, that's a really difficult thing to estimate. Usually for your garden variety magnitude 3 or 4 earthquake, we tend to think of it in terms of millimeters. For the larger earthquakes, there have been reports of people claiming that they saw waves in the ground as high as 3 feet. That's the human impressions. At a time when everything is just going to pieces around them, tend to magnify the real phenomena. I'm really not up on exactly technically how much things move, but during the Great Alaska Earthquake in 64, apparently based on tidal measurements, water level measurements in Houston, the ground moved maybe inches as far away as Houston. So you can imagine what it must have been close to the epicenter.
Wow.
And, of course, there was actual offset there where places were lifted up a meter or two, you know, maybe 10 feet as much.
Remember pictures of the San Francisco earthquake and also the Alaska quake with the
big offsets,
right?
Yeah, big vertical offsets.
Yeah. You call it a vertical offset. I saw it. Call it a huge hole in the ground. There was an article by Larry Gedney that I read in a Northern Engineer that you gave me that helped me get a grip on how much the earth moved and why we feel it so dramatic. He said if you put a man in the center of a board, 2x4, and stand him up on it and put a guy at either end, and if they pick up that board and walk it across the room, the man in the center is going to keep his balance pretty well. If on the other end, they'll go quite a distance, but he'll keep his balance because the movement is slow. He said, think of an earthquake as the two fellows picking up opposite ends of the boards and just shaking it back and forth. The gentleman in the center can't keep his balance, and it's because of the acceleration.
Right.
So what he was thinking, the way he was explaining this earthquake, is the earth may not move very far, a couple of inches like you described with your hand, but that it moves so fast that we think we moved to Cleveland in the process.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The perception is going to be very distorted.
Right. Which is why you'd see waves in walls and the like, too.
Right.
Because everything's moving, yeah.
John Davies tells a story about an earthquake which occurred here. He said that he was walking, I believe, from upper campus to lower campus. And as this earthquake was occurring, he could swear that he was seeing waves in the sidewalk going from West Ridge down to lower campus, waves of amplitude maybe 2 feet. And only a seismologist would do this. Like, we all look at our watch when we start to feel something and count the time between the first wave and the second wave. But he says that the first thing he did was get down on his hands and knees when it was over and crawl along the sidewalk looking for cracks in the sidewalk, thinking if they were really that big, then surely the concrete would have failed. But he didn't see little cracks in the sidewalk. So the assumption is that his perception was somehow distorted. His balance, maybe. I don't know.
Right. or all the factors that make up a human being. I mean, we're right. spiritual, intellectual, emotional, physical,
exactly.
all at the same time. And, yeah.
and however scientific you are, the first thing that hits you, mm-hmm. it's going to be a little while before you get a grip on yourself and say, no, wait, that cannot have been.
That was not a wave.
Yes, right.
It was.
Yes, it was.
Yes, it was. Yes, it was. We're talking about earthquakes today on Sunday at noon. This is seismologist Charlotte Rowe. I'm Susan McGinnis for KUAC. The different ways that you... I want to talk about magnitudes and both how you register an earthquake as a seismologist and how we register quakes. We just talked about John walking down the street mm-hmm. registering it quite differently than any seismograph might measure it, certainly. But can we talk about your tools of measurement?
Okay.
And the tools of measurement that allow us to give a scale to earthquakes also?
Well, the tools that we use are called seismometers. And all they do, simply, is measure how much the ground moves. Some of them actually measure the velocity of movement, and some of them measure the acceleration, and some of them actually measure the displacement. Mm-hmm. So there are a number of different ways that we can read this, but basically it's looking at ground motion.
And they sit on the fault sites, right?
Or they sit everywhere.
Okay. They don't sit in a lab. They sit out
in
the world.
No, they sit out in the world. We have a network around the state with, maybe 120 stations or more right now, just scattered from Barrow and Nome and Fort Yukon all the way down into the Aleutians and Cook Inlet and Prince William Sound and Juneau, of course, Fairbanks. Mm-hmm. And what these instruments do, they work on a very simple principle. They have a magnet suspended on very stiff springs. And there's a coil of wire that's not attached to the magnet. The coil of wire is attached to the outside of the instrument.
And it sits under the magnet?
Under the magnet, okay. Right. Now, the instrument is very firmly planted on the ground. If we can put it on a concrete pier, that's great. We dig a hole and bury it. In some places, we'll just dig a hole, put it in there, and pour water on it, and it's frozen for eternity right where we put it. But these instruments... measure up and down motion, so we call them vertical component instruments. What happens is when the ground shakes up and down, the magnet, because it's on springs, will tend to stay still, but since the instrument's moving, the magnet is moving with respect to the instrument. Okay. And so you have the coil of wire attached to the instrument moving in a magnetic field, and it generates an electric current. Now that current is translated into a signal. For a remote station, it will be a radio signal. For a station that we can hook up to power and everything, we'll send it right over the telephone lines as a tone, an audible tone. Mm-hmm. And if the ground moves, then the tone goes up and down, just like that. And each instrument has its own tone on a phone line. The tone comes into the lab, and then it gets translated back into motion of a pen on the drum or a digital signal that goes into our computer. Now, when an earthquake occurs, it sends out these waves radially, like we discussed before. The instruments that are closest to the source will see these waves first. Mm-hmm. And instruments farther away, it'll take longer for the seismic waves to get to them. Now, if we know where our instruments are, and if we know approximately how fast these waves travel through the ground, then based on the time that the wave arrives at the instruments, we can calculate backwards and figure out where the earthquake occurred.
Okay. Pretty amazing.
Yeah, well,
it's pretty exciting, too. You've got all these
little...
It's
pretty neat, yeah.
Yeah.
Once we know where the earthquake occurred, then we can figure out how big it was in what we call the Richter magnitude. And the Richter magnitude scale is not really a Toledo that you bring out and you weigh the earthquake
on. Very disappointing to me. It's not a scale.
A lot of people come up in the lab and say, can you bring out your Richter scale and
sure.
show it to me? How do you measure an earthquake on it?
And at the very least, draw it for me.
Right. What's it look like?
It's from 1 to 10, right? That's what I understood, that it was from 1 to 10.
And you just kind of lay the earthquake on it? And
yeah. That's no closer than a Toledo scale. So now you have to tell us what a Richter scale is.
Well, it's actually a mathematical relationship. It's not a device. But it's based on what we see on our devices. If you have a seismometer very close to the epicenter of an earthquake, the shaking of the ground will be very great. And so the motion of the pen, mm-hmm. once it finally gets to the lab, will be very great. Mm-hmm. Now, if we can measure how much that pen moved, if we know how far away the earthquake was, then we can say, well, we were this far from the earthquake and the ground moved this much. So taking into account the distance, we can figure out how much energy was released at the source of the earthquake. A more distant seismometer would have a smaller signal on it, but it's farther away and our distance calculation will account for that. So we get pretty reasonable agreement between a number of stations at a vast variety of different distances from the instrument.
The station down in Houston, when you said the earth moved in Houston when the ground shook in Alaska, that registers. A station in New York
registered. Sure, a station in Antarctica registered. When you have a very large earthquake, any seismic instrument around the world will see it. Anything greater than maybe magnitude 6, you could be certain of seeing.
And you get more and more precise in judging how much the earth moved at the epicenter in Alaska by talking to Houston and New York and Antarctica, by looking at their graphs?
Well, yeah. Any instrument that you have measuring the ground motion is going to be subject to a variety of things that might interfere with the accuracy of the measurement. So if you can get readings from all over the world, or in the case of our sort of regular daily earthquake activity in the state, all over the state, and you just average the readings. Some will say a little bigger, some will say a little smaller, but we feel pretty comfortable with something that's about in the middle. So if, say, a local earthquake in Fairbanks, if the instruments in the Fairbanks area, one might give us a 3.1, one might say 2.9. All around, we'd come up with a conclusion that this earthquake was about a 3.0. So it's a matter of averaging these stations together, because the ground responds differently depending on the direction you are from the source. And we have to take that into account.
I want to ask you a question that you say you get asked a lot, because probably someone out there is wondering it. And that is, if the earthquake measures 3.0 in Fairbanks, what does it measure in Anchorage?
3.0.
Yeah.
The 3.0 refers to the amount of energy which was released at the source. A very good analogy that I've heard for this was if you think of a light bulb. And if you walk into a dark room and you screw a 100-watt bulb into the ceiling, the energy that's being put out in terms of light and heat from this bulb is 100 watts. If you're standing right under the light bulb, so you're right there at the source, whatever you're reading is illuminated very brightly. The intensity of light on the page is very great from this 100-watt light bulb. 3.0 light bulb, 100-watt. Right. If you walk to the other side of the room, it's going to be dimmer. You'll be less aware that there's a really bright light bulb in the room, but that doesn't change the fact that the light bulb over on the other side of the room is 100 watts. If you walk outside, you can't even tell that there's a light on, but that does not change the fact that at the source, you've got a 100-watt bulb or a magnitude 3.0 earthquake.
Okay. What else do we need to know about the Richter scale measurements of earthquakes? Because I want to move also to the Mercalli scale, which measures our responses and artifactual responses to an earthquake. But what else do you think is important for people listening to know about the Richter scale and how it measures earthquakes?
Well, for one thing, the Richter scale is open-ended. There is no maximum. It is capable of handling however big an earthquake the Earth is capable of creating. The largest earthquakes ever recorded since we have been able to record come in somewhere around 9, slightly above magnitude 9. Also, you can go down to very, very small earthquakes on the Richter scale. You can get down to 0. You can even go to negative magnitudes. It's a logarithmic scale, so each level, it's log base 10, which means each level, 2 compared to a 1, it's 10 times bigger. A magnitude 5 is 10 times bigger than a magnitude 4. So if we have a magnitude 3 earthquake in Fairbanks, and then you hear on the news the next day that there was a magnitude 4 in Nenana, what that tells you is, oh, well, theirs wasn't just 25% bigger. It was 10 times bigger. So when you start thinking, well, we can feel a magnitude 3 here, it'll shake things a little bit. People will start calling the lab. People will wonder. They'll say, oh, it was an earthquake. Big deal. Go back to sleep, whatever. When you think, well, what's a magnitude 5 or magnitude 6? Well, you're talking about something 100 times stronger or 1,000 times stronger.
And it depends on how deep in the earth the the hypercenter is located? Do we feel earthquakes that are located shallow more greatly than we feel earthquakes located deep?
We would feel them differently. A shallow earthquake will be a lot closer to us than a deep earthquake. So an earthquake that's, say, 50 kilometers down and offset from you by 100 kilometers, technically you're looking at the hypotenuse of that triangle as to how far really it is in a direct line. Mm-hmm. It's that much farther away, so you'd be that much less likely to feel things. On the other hand, the Earth acts like a high-frequency filter. And what that means is that when the Earth shakes at the source of an earthquake, there are all kinds of different shakings going on, some very fast, some very slow. And all of these kinds of waves will travel out away from the earthquake. But the farther away you get from the earthquake, the more of these longer period waves or the slow rolling waves will be left. But the real high frequency vibrating shaking ones are going to...
Building dumpers.
Right. Right. Well, the ones that are going to rattle your window panes or make you feel like a truck has hit the side of your house, a very sudden jolt, a sharp rattling, those are going to die off within a very short distance away from the earthquake. So a very deep earthquake may not give you as much of this rattling, but you'll feel the rolling.
Good. The earthquake, the great one of 64, as they call it, or they misname it the Anchorage quake, because it really was located down in Valdez, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was one of the largest earthquakes that we know about. It was a 9-point-something?
9.2, yes. I think there was an earthquake in Chile, which was larger, a 9.5, a couple decades ago.
And this one, you may be as able as a seismologist to tell me more about it than I can. But it destroyed the city of Valdez, made great, tremendous inroads into destroying Anchorage.
A mess.
Yeah.
It was a mess.
Was there a tsunami created?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah,
yes.
That's what wiped Valdez out, right?
That's what did an awful lot of the damage. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the tsunamis went on for hours. Seismic sea waves. They went in for hours afterwards.
Tell us what happens to create a tsunami and why it's so devastating. Well, clearly, one can just think why it's so devastating.
Well, when the Earth moves, it can move a number of different ways. You could have vertical displacement. You could have a piece move up sharply or down sharply on either side of this fault. Mm-hmm. Or you could have sideways motion. Now, if you have sideways motion, for an earthquake which occurs under the ocean, you can imagine you probably won't displace a whole lot of water. You're not going to move.
It's like a foot shuffle, nothing much
right,
happened
there. Right. Yeah. If you jumped in your bathtub, you'd displace a lot of water and you'd splash all over the place. It's the same kind of thing. You have a big change in the ocean floor, and that's going to make a big change in the water immediately over it, and that can cause a big sea wave.
It leaves a hole, and the water just roars into
right.
that.
Right,
and
exactly.
then it has to go someplace because it roared into
right.
something,
it's
and so
go
it
right
goes
back
up.
The other way. Yeah. Right. And these big sea waves go all the way around the world. Soon, a large earthquake which generates a large tsunami, that wave will be detected, Japan and New Zealand, everywhere. Some places it will be bigger than other places. That depends a whole lot on the local, the configuration of the harbors and the sea bottom and everything. But the waves can travel, they've estimated as fast as maybe a few hundred miles an hour.
That's
out
fast.
In the deep ocean. That's very fast. And of course, the wave is not very high out in the deep ocean. It's traveling very fast, though. And when it gets close to a shore, it starts to slow down, and all of the energy that was being expended in speed turns into piling the water up very high. So what doesn't appear to be necessarily that high a wave out in the ocean, once it starts to come close to a shore, it can generate a breaker of tremendous height, and the run-up can be extremely high.
So if I'm imaging something that's a 100-foot wall of water coming at me from at 60 or 70 miles an hour, I might be pretty close to what's happening.
Yes. And you might want to be 101 feet above high tide.
I remember reading a story about two gentlemen and their sons, I think, who were down... Oh, I read this so long ago, but they were down in Valdez when somebody started to warn them about the tsunami, and I think they just ran and ran and ran and ran up the hill with what they mm-hmm. what they described as this, and I don't think they all made it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think they were among the people killed, but the survivors described it as just trying to race ahead of this thing that was not stopping and had the power, just to, pardon me, microphone, to flatten them right to the earth, mm-hmm. you know, and then drown them on top of it.
And it derailed trains and turned them over and moved boats all the way up into the middle of town. It tremendous destruction. In fact, in all of recorded history, there have been some 13 million people killed as a result of earthquakes, and a majority of those have died as a result of secondary effects, principally tsunami, also plagues and mm-hmm. fires, mm-hmm. Aftershocks, which bring down structures that were damaged but not brought down in the main shock. So tsunami is a major concern, and the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, operates a tsunami warning center in Palmer, and they have their own network of seismometers in the state, principally for the purpose of monitoring large earthquakes which would occur beneath the ocean floor.
So that there's some warning.
Right. And as soon as there's a large earthquake under the ocean, if it's large enough, they will issue a tsunami warning. They won't know for a while whether or not there's actually going to be a tsunami, because they have to collect data from stations around the world before they can determine whether the ocean floor moved up and down or sideways. And if it moved up and down, of course, there's a potential for a large wave. If it moves sideways, there's probably not going to be much problem.
But the warning centers can get the word out that we might have a problem here, and then, after a period of time, can say, we do have a problem.
Well, of course, by that time, if there was one, it's already been
seen.
It's done.
Yeah. Okay. So there's not much time.
Right.
There's one other aspect of the movement of the Earth that I know you're very familiar with, and in the state of Alaska, we're increasingly familiar with it, and that's the volcano uh-huh. coming out of the Earth. And I wonder if we can pause and take a look at a volcano before we take a look at predictions of Earth movement, because you can also predict, in a way, volcanic activity, right?
In a way,
so
yeah.
Let's take a look at volcanoes from your perspective. We've got a lot of them in Alaska.
We do. Yes. We have something like 40 active volcanoes in the state. Most of those are down in the Aleutian Island Arc. The volcanoes are created as a result of this subduction, which also generates the earthquakes. That's not to say that the earthquakes cause the volcanoes, or the volcanoes cause the earthquakes. This is not true. There is no connection, really.
We like to believe it, though.
Right. We get a lot of phone calls in the lab, people asking us, oh, there was a big earthquake in Cook Inlet, and somebody said that readout just popped off again. So did the volcano cause the earthquake, or did the earthquake trigger the volcano? Well, no. They are both related to the fact that the Earth is moving, and that we have this subduction zone in this part of the state. The volcanoes are a result of the oceanic slab as it goes down underneath the overriding material. There's friction, which generates heat.
Right.
It's also being heated up and under a great deal of pressure, just because the Earth is warmer, and as you go deeper down, the overlying pressure from the rocks is greater. And you start to get some melting of the material on this slab, because it's not identical to the stuff that it's going down into. It's been altered chemically by the water, the ocean floor, and everything, so it's more susceptible to melting. Mm-hmm. And as it begins to melt, this molten material is less dense than the material around it, and it begins to rise. It's just buoyancy.
That's what you call magma.
Magma, yes. Yeah. Uh-huh. And the magma rises towards the surface. Probably much of it is chilled and stopped long before it gets there, but if it happens to break through the surface, then you have an eruption, and you start to build a volcano. And we have a whole string of them. And all of them are lined up pretty much over about the same level of this downgoing slab, when the slab is between 100 and 150 kilometers down, so maybe 60 to 100 miles deep. We have the chain of volcanoes over that level of the slab.
That's fascinating, I think. It's just fascinating to me that the Earth moves and then that it builds things and erupts and the like. Does what make a volcano? No. Does the same thing make a volcano erupt on the surface as does under the ocean?
Well, it's built itself up high enough, or in the case of Readout, which is sort of on the Alaska landmass, it's not an island out in the ocean,
right.
The magma has worked its way up through the continental material overlying, and it has reached the surface. And through repeated eruptions, as it spews stuff out and it falls back down around, it builds up a mountain.
And keeps building up pressure inside to explode?
Builds up pressure inside. Right. The magma, when it reaches the surface, we call it lava. And this is a very sort of a thick, viscous sort of a plastic lava. It's not very thin and fluid like the basaltic volcanoes in Hawaii. Mm-hmm. This lava will end up capping off the top of the volcano. And once an eruption is finished, the gases contained in it have been expended, so there's no more pressure pushing the material out. It's capped off by this lava. And that manages to hold down any gases that begin to build up again. Yeah. And as the material tries to force its way up, it can't. And it builds up more and more and more and more and more. And finally, it blows the top off as if you had shaken a bottle of champagne and the cork popped.
Got it. And how do you predict, or in what ways can you predict volcanic eruptions? Is it something to do with the pressure and you figure that soon enough this volcano is just going to have enough buildup and it's going to have to blow?
Well, it's because of two things, the pressure, and the volcano inflates like a balloon when it fills up with magma trying to push up inside it. It actually expands, and we can measure this deforming of the volcano. The deforming of the volcano can be measured with surveying instruments and also measured with seismometers, because as it deforms, it creaks and groans and cracks and pops, and as the magma pushes up, it causes fractures to open, and those will creak and pop. So we have networks of these seismometers on the volcanoes, and when the volcano starts building up pressure inside and expanding, we'll get an awful lot of seismic signal from this volcano, and eventually it will be so intense that we know something is going on.
There's just not enough room in that pot for everything to stay in there and
That's
boil the
right.
way it's boiling.
Yeah.
What about predictions for earthquakes? You talked to me the other day about how the earth keeps moving and keeps moving, and there'll be an earthquake here and an earthquake there that lets off pressure or snaps the earth in one way or the other. And one of the ways you anticipate great earthquakes is by looking at seismic gaps, places that aren't having earthquakes.
Exactly. If you could imagine the earth pushing along, forcing its way in some direction, and it's slipping along some sort of a fracture, but part of it's stuck. And on one end it slips and it slips and it slips, and on the other end it slips and slips and slips, but it's still stuck in the middle, maybe a very large, maybe several hundred miles portion along this fault is stuck.
Movement all around it, and so it's under great pressure to move, but it's not moving.
Until the amount of stress exceeds the friction that's holding it still.
And this is why they say there's going to be a great quake on the San Andreas, probably in Southern California, but it's also possible that it might be in Northern California again, because there are places along those fault lines that just aren't moving. They're just not giving off steam or letting off energy in small quakes.
Right. And they base these predictions on what they've been able to record in terms of earthquakes and the probability.
We look all the way back to 1896, and we say we had so many quakes of such a magnitude, and the Earth generally in that part of the world does this, and it's not doing it now.
Right. Yeah. And for instance, in the San Francisco earthquake in 1906, a very extensive part of the fault ruptured. And using that as a baseline, saying, okay, let's assume that all the stress was relieved on this fault in this huge earthquake. Now we can record things, and we're beginning to see the stress is released in this part and the stress is released in that part, but not here. And so we think that this part is going to rupture, and based on the length of the part that is stuck, if all that ruptures at once, it's likely to generate an earthquake of magnitude such and such. The Loma Prieta earthquake was predicted, a qualified prediction. It's always statistical. There's probabilities attached to it, just like the probability of rain or something. But the statistical probability was very great in the part of the fault which actually did rupture. And although they could not say when, they can only say, well, within the next 20 years or so, we feel that there is a 40% or a 60% chance that we'll have an earthquake. They had a real good feeling for how big. They were saying something on the order of magnitude 6.5 or 7. That's exactly what they got.
Yeah. What about Alaska? You, one of the reasons we got into this discussion was in a phone call you happened to say, it looks like we could have another one soon. And I thought, well, how soon? The last great quake in Alaska, which was much larger than the one in San Francisco,
right,
in 1906, was in 1964. Uh-huh. What signs make you believe we should have another one? And where do seismologists think it might be?
Well, there are a number of seismic gaps along the ocean and continent margin as we see it in Alaska. There's a gap out in the Shumagin Islands that we feel is the potential source of a magnitude 8 earthquake or so. There's another one around in the Yakutat area. And, of course, there hasn't been a significantly large earthquake recurring along the part of the fault that ruptured for the 64 earthquake. Mm-hmm. In terms of actually being able to say in so many years we'd expect an earthquake of so big, that's for the people who've been playing with the statistical programs for down there. However, because we believe that the Earth is dynamic and that it's moving at about the same rate it always has been, the plates are converging. They can actually measure the rate of convergence maybe 5 to 7 centimeters a year. So that's, 3 inches or so a year. This is going on, and it's still going on. It has not stopped. There have been great earthquakes before of that magnitude, and they can find that in the record of the beaches that have been uplifted and uplifted and uplifted catastrophically. These old fossil beaches exist on some of the islands, and the offset for each catastrophic offset is no less than the 64 earthquake.
Huh.
So in terms of the recurrence rate, because we haven't been instrumented that long, and an earthquake of this magnitude probably would not recur as often as a 5 or a 6, that's not something that we can point to the seismic record and say, look, we've had a 9.2 every 220 years. This has to be based an awful lot on estimates that geologists make looking at field evidence and things like that. But we have no reason to think that there won't be another one sometime.
I keep thinking about the fact that we have a 9.2 earthquake in Alaska and San Francisco has a 7.8 and is likely to have a 7.8 and we're likely to have a 9.2. Is it just dumb geologic luck that Alaska, which is the largest state with the fewest people, has a 9.2 quake and San Francisco has a 7.8? Not that that another one of that magnitude wouldn't be horribly devastating, but think of what a 9.2 quake would do if it rocked the San Francisco Bay Area.
I would say, yeah.
Just dumb luck.
Dumb geologic luck. Yeah. And
in Armenia, 25,000 people died in that quake.
Yes.
Yeah.
Lisbon, the great earthquake in Lisbon, killed tens of thousands of people. In China, they've had earthquakes which have killed hundreds of thousands of people.
Right. In a land of a billion people, they're all pretty vulnerable.
You don't hear as much about it. You tend to hear about whatever is going to affect the major commerce areas. San Francisco is, of course, a port and a major population center and a major broadcast center. Mm-hmm. And the way we're all connected up with the world today, any place where you have an awful lot of people whose lives and whose finances and everything focus on a particular area, when something happens that's extremely disabling for that area, it's really going to stick in people's minds. Another thing that impacts our awareness of earthquakes is what else is going on in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Volcanic eruptions and earthquakes happened with fair regularity throughout history. However, if there was a huge war going on, you didn't hear as much about them.
Right. It was the greater news that caught the
right. Ear. It's a matter of perception.
What people, I'm sure, might be wondering, since we're broadcasting this to Fairbanks, what general magnitude of earthquake we can expect in and around Fairbanks? Is there a way to predict we'll probably have the kind of quake we had out in Minto Flats a couple of months ago, which was a 5.0?
Oh, yes.
Greater?
Greater. Fairbanks has experienced magnitude 6 and 7 earthquakes. It was 1967. We had about a magnitude 6. Maybe it was a 5.6. I'm not sure. It was bigger than the Minto Flats earthquake. It was located just south of town. Mm-hmm. It caused a lot of damage in terms of mostly superficial plate glass windows and things knocked off shelves and such. It was, we don't have much in the way of elevated freeways to collapse or huge skyscrapers to come down. In Salsha, there was an earthquake which registered greater than magnitude 7 on the Richter scale. Wow. In fact, in the interior of Alaska, north of the Alaska Range, south of the Brooks Range, since the turn of the century, there have been 5 earthquakes whose magnitudes were greater than or equal to 7. The recurrence rate for those was approximately 13 years, and it's been more than 30 years since the last one. So you could look at that and say the interior is overdue for a magnitude 7 earthquake. But to try and pin that down and say Fairbanks is overdue might be stretching it a little bit, because all of these occurred on different faults.
Right. And the interior is so large.
Right.
Stretch out. Yeah.
So that's not a real good statistical basis for predicting. However, in terms of small earthquakes, magnitude 3s, 4s, 5s, which is getting into the moderate range, definitely we will continue to have them. I don't think there's anybody living in Fairbanks who hasn't felt a number of small earthquakes.
Sure.
We tend to get them in swarms here. We'll go for a period of 2 or 3 weeks where we'll just get dozens and
shake, dozens of them.
And then it'll be quiet for a few months.
I mentioned earlier that I wanted to take a look at another kind of scale, and then I
forgot the
Mercalli scale. Can we do that briefly? Because that's the human reaction, an artifact scale.
Yes. The Mercalli scale is rated from 1 to 12, and they're Roman numerals, and that helps us distinguish when we look at intensity versus magnitude, which are often confused terms. The Mercalli has an I, and the Richter is numerals.
Right.
The
Arabic. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Right. Yes, 1, 2, 3, 4. The Mercalli scale measures the perceptions. It measures the visible effects of an earthquake. And it ranges all the way from a 1, which is nobody notices, to 2, 3, 4, where you go through various phases of some people will feel a little nauseous because their inner ear is upset. Animals, domestic animals, may get upset. You'll start to see picture frames knocked a little askew, chandeliers sway, window panes rattle, and you get more and more intense. You get furniture moved, houses moved from their foundations, pendulum clock stop, chimneys fall down,
right,
all the way up to total annihilation, which would be the 12.
And you judge by the Mercalli scale from the people who call you and say, whoa, it was way out here in Salcha and all the cans fell off the shelf. And you can have one gauge as a seismologist to look at that. In human response terms, it was an X.
That helps us a lot. Of course, our principal focus tends to be on the quantitative, the Richter magnitude and the hypocentral depth and things like that. But any study of earthquakes has of necessity to look at the human impact as well, particularly because our function as a state agency is to monitor the earthquakes, the seismicity, the effects, and to be able to coordinate with public safety people in terms of what areas tend to be impacted and how earthquakes of this size have affected this kind of a structure and things like that. So getting this information, getting this feedback allows us to construct a picture of what happens with different size earthquakes, aside from what we know about the waves and the ground motion itself.
We're just about out of time. I want to say, because I've forgotten in the last few minutes to say, that we've been listening to Charlotte Rowe, who's a seismologist, the staff seismologist with the Geophysical Institute at the UAF, with the Alaska Earthquake Information Center, and also the Alaska Volcano Observatory. I have one more question, though.
Okay.
During the Loma Prieta earthquake, my folks who live in Marin County, my stepdad grabbed my mom and they went and stood under the load-bearing doorway. And my mom talked to me the next morning when I could finally get through to them. And I said, where were you? She says, under the doorway. But it took everything I had to stay there because the doorway was shaking. She said, I wanted to run outside. Where's the safest place? Where should you really be?
She did the right thing.
They did the right thing.
Yeah.
Stay in that doorway.
Get under a heavy piece of furniture if you have a real sturdy old, like, government surplus desk or something like that. Get under there with a pillow over your head too or something, under anything that is going to protect you from whatever is going to fall. Ceiling fixtures, ceiling tiles. Don't go outside. The last thing you should do is run outside, because a lot of people are killed because things fall off buildings. Concrete siding falls down, cornices, balconies, chimneys, any superficial structure that is not a part of the integral supporting part of the building is likely to come down. There's a story in this Time Life book about a woman in Anchorage who was in the Penny's building, which was, of course, demolished. Mm. And she tried to make her way outside. She got to the door. As soon as she got to the door, for some reason she stopped, although everything told her to go out. And as she stood there, the whole facade of the building crashed down and squished a bunch of people right outside. But she had stayed in the doorway.
She stood in the doorway safe. Word of the wise, folks, stay in your doorways. I'm Susan McGinnis for Sunday at Noon. Thank you very much, Charlotte Rowe. It's been a most engaging hour. Next week, John Luther Adams, our own composer from KUAC-FM. We're going to talk about his new radio symphony. Thank you all. Have a good Sunday.